welcome to the debate. You know, usually when we look at a map, there is this fundamental expectation of accuracy, right? Like representation. If you see a thick blue line, you expect a river to be there.
Right. If you see a green shaded area, you trust there's a forest.
Exactly. The map is supposed to reflect the actual physical reality of the ground beneath us.
Yeah, but I mean, it necessarily simplifies that reality. The map flattens a mountain into, you know, topographic rings so we can safely navigate it. But nobody actually confuses the piece of paper for the mountain itself. It remains just a representation.
Except when we look at the global financial system. In that space, suddenly, the map itself has become the territory. We've started treating the financial ledger, the balance sheet, the credit score, the debt metric, as if it is vastly more real than the physical world it was originally designed to represent.
Oh, absolutely.
Today, what is on the balance sheet gets built, protected, and rescued. And what is left off the balance sheet, say, a dying coral reef, or an uncollateralized community, it simply ceases to exist institutionally.
It is a system where the representation dictates reality. And while my position is that this is actually incredibly effective, and perhaps the only way to manage a globally integrated civilization.
And that is exactly the tension we are examining today. We are looking at the fundamental architecture of our global financial system, focusing specifically on this concept of credit sovereignty.
Right.
We are drawing upon Dr. Bachara Saley's comprehensive white paper, The Sovereignty of Credit. And this text argues that beneath our highly visible political constitutions, you know, the legislatures we elect, the courts, the executives, lies a hidden credit constitution.
Yes, it's this incredibly complex network of commercial laws, central banking protocols, and market conventions. And this hidden constitution ultimately dictates which imagined futures actually receive the funding to become reality and, well, which remain mere aspirations.
The central question we have to grapple with today is frankly profound. Should this global financial constitution be fundamentally restructured? Should it prioritize human and ecological capacities over contractual financial claims?
Or, as I'll be arguing, does the rigid priority of financial claims remain the absolute essential mechanism for coordinating human cooperation across time and distance?
Right. So you're taking the side of the current claims hierarchy.
I am. I take the position that the strict enforcement of financial representation over underlying reality, which, you know, the text critiques as organized not knowing, is precisely what makes complex economic civilization and the management of massive future risks possible.
And I will be arguing that we are currently suffering from what the text calls the great financial inversion. I believe we absolutely have to transition to a life-grounded hierarchy of claims. Let's break down exactly what that means, because my perspective is rooted in a fundamental reality here. Credit is not just a private transaction between two willing parties.
Okay.
It is a delegated public power.
How so? I mean, a bank lending to a local business feels like a highly private arrangement.
It feels that way, yeah. But commercial banks create deposit money under a public license. They settle their accounts through central bank infrastructure, which is backed by the state.
Right, the clearing system.
Exactly. So when a bank allocates credit, they are essentially allocating social possibility using public machinery. The text meticulously details this great financial inversion. We have reached a condition where abstract financial claims have become more institutionally visible and, honestly, infinitely better protected than the actual life capacities.
The people, the communities, the ecosystems.
Exactly. The very things upon which their value ultimately depends.
But, you know, protected is doing a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence. Protected how exactly?
Protected in terms of the speed and scale of rescue. We see this every time there's a crisis. Just think about it. If a major systemically important bank is failing on a Friday afternoon, the central bank will literally invent a new multi-billion dollar emergency lending facility by Sunday night to save it.
To prevent contagion, yes.
Right. Trillions can be mobilized overnight to protect the monetary core. Meanwhile, if a coastal community's water table is permanently poisoned by saltwater intrusion or an ecosystem faces total collapse, they are left waiting for slow, highly contested, decade-long political processes to get a single seawall funded.
Wow. Yeah.
It's an inversion of reality. The financial claim gets an immediate rescue. The physical foundation of life gets put on a political waiting list.
Look, I come at it from a different way. I understand why that disparity feels jarring. It looks like a moral failure. But your critique, while identifying real friction, I think it misunderstands the very mechanics of why the system was built this way in the first place.
I don't think it's a misunderstanding. I think the design itself is flawed. I argue we must enforce a life-grounded hierarchy where basic life necessities and ecological viability are legally protected before residual financial claims are serviced.
But you can't just mandate that without unraveling the machinery that allows us to fund those life necessities. The historical construction of credit sovereignty, you know, from merchant bills of exchange in the Atlantic trade to funding public debt and modern corporate forms, it was painstakingly built to solve massive existential problems.
Problems of distance and time.
Yes. Distance, time, and uncertainty. Financial claims must have strict, legally enforceable priority. As the text itself acknowledges, reliable claims allow strangers to cooperate across distance and time.
Sure, strangers cooperating is fine, but not at the expense of the physical world.
But the physical world requires long-term coordination to maintain. I mean, a pension claim protects deferred wages for a worker's retirement decades from now. A 30-year municipal bond finances the very water treatment plant that keeps a city healthy.
Right.
If you dilute these strictly binding contractual obligations with fluid, qualitative, life-grounded measures, you risk destroying the portability and liquidity of those promises.
Because the investor won't know if they're actually going to get paid?
Exactly. The system's so-called organized not knowing, this deliberate boundary that keeps external harms or qualitative social metrics off the immediate balance sheet, is not a bug. It is a necessary institutional boundary.
You really think it's necessary?
It prevents the total collapse of systemic trust. Without that strict legibility, without knowing that a dollar owed is a dollar legally prioritized, the capacity to mobilize private resources for the very survival of communities just evaporates. Nobody buys the bond to build a seawall if the city can just legally declare that its ecological viability means it no longer has to pay back the bondholders.
But this prioritization doesn't just happen in the abstract, right?
Let's test that boundary by looking at how it behaves under extreme stress. The text outlines the hierarchy of the protectable.
Right, during a panic. Yeah, when a crisis hits, central banks unconditionally protect the monetary core and secured claims first. Employment, community continuity, and ecosystems sit at the absolute bottom of that rescue list. This is the constitutional inversion I'm talking about.
But they aren't mutually exclusive.
You simply cannot sustain a mortgage market if the underlying community is biologically or socially collapsing. To insist on paying the bondholders while a local hospital loses its funding or a crucial watershed dries up is suicidal. The financial claim is derived from the life ground. Therefore, the life ground must be protected first.
Okay, but you are looking at the outcome and assuming malintent or like a flawed moral compass. You're ignoring the mechanics of transmission. The text correctly admits that payment collapse can transmit harm rapidly. Let me give an analogy here. The payment system is exactly like the electrical grid of a hospital.
Okay, yeah, I'm with you.
If the grid fails, the life support machines, what you are calling the life ground, the actual breathing patients, fail instantly and catastrophically. The central bank intervenes to save the monetary core on a Sunday night, not because bankers are more morally deserving than ecosystems, but because a run on wholesale funding or a collapse of the clearing system will immediately freeze payrolls everywhere.
It halts the economy.
It will halt supply chains. It will literally stop food from reaching grocery stores on Monday morning. Rescuing the monetary core first is an absolute operational necessity for preserving life. It is the prerequisite for any political process to even exist.
I see why you think that. But let me give you a different perspective. The hospital grid analogy is a really good one, but let's push it further. Rescuing the electrical grid is fine. I am not arguing against financial stability, and honestly, the text isn't either.
Right.
The problem is that our current resolution frameworks have historically protected the incumbent owners of the grid, not just the function of the grid.
Wait, what do you mean by that distinction?
Well, when we rescue a systemic institution, we often do it without wiping out the equity holders or without fundamentally restructuring the underlying debt that caused the fragility in the first place.
Ah.
We use immense public power to immunize private wealth. The text proposes a very clear rule: protect function before ownership. We can keep the payments flowing, we can keep the hospital's lights on, without ensuring that the private equity firm holding the debt gets paid 100 cents on the dollar. while the nurses are forced to take a pay cut to balance the budget.
That's a strong point.
The hierarchy needs to prioritize the continuity of the essential service, not the preservation of the financial claim.
That's a fair distinction. But I think you're working with an outdated model of how financial rescues operate today. Modern resolution frameworks actually do distinguish between critical functions and incumbent ownership much better than they did, say, 20 years ago. This is exactly what bail-in mechanics were designed to do.
Let's clarify what a bail-in actually is for the listener, because it's fundamentally different from a taxpayer bailout.
Right. So in a traditional bailout, the government steps in with taxpayer money to cover a failing bank's losses so it doesn't collapse. But with a bail-in, regulators force the bank's existing creditors and bondholders to take the hit.
They write down the value.
Yes, they legally write down the value of the bank's debt, or they convert that debt into equity. The original shareholders get completely wiped out. The investors lose their money, but the bank itself is instantly recapitalized from within.
So the function survives.
Exactly. The doors stay open, ATMs still work, payrolls clear, but the incumbent owners pay the price. So we do have mechanisms to protect function over ownership.
We have the legal framework for bail-ins, yes. But in practice, regulators are still absolutely terrified to trigger them for the largest institutions because they fear market contagion. But even if we assume bail-ins work perfectly, you are still proving my point here.
How so?
The system bends over backward to engineer complex mechanisms to save the financial architecture. But if you try to apply that same urgency to subordinating senior financial claims to qualitative social metrics, like saying, "This bank's loans are driving deforestation. We must restructure them." The system just throws up its hands.
Knows that their legal claim to repayment can be randomly subordinated because a regulator decides the hospital needs to increase its qualitative social metrics by offering free care. They simply won't buy the bond. The certainty of the claim is what makes the funding possible.
But this systemic protection of the status quo doesn't just happen during a panic. You can see the exact same logic in how everyday loans are handed out. Let's move to the micro level of how capital is actually allocated. The text explores this deeply through the concept of legibility.
Meaning how easy it is for a bank to understand and price a risk?
Exactly. Financial institutions require highly simplified, legible indicators to make lending scalable. They look at land titles, credit scores, collateral. If it fits the spreadsheet, you get the loan.
Makes sense.
But this creates a massive cumulative advantage. Those who already hold property, which the text rightly points out, is often inherited from deeply unequal colonial eras and extractive legal frameworks, they get access to much cheaper credit.
Well, yeah, because collateral reduces the risk of the loan.
Right. But what do they do with that cheap credit? They use it to buy more assets, driving up prices and concentrating wealth. Meanwhile, crucial life necessities like ecological repair, community adaptation to climate change, or public health infrastructure are starved of capital.
Because they aren't legible in the same way.
Exactly. Because their benefits are diffuse. They don't generate a neat quarterly cash flow that can be collateralized. To fix this, the text argues we need plural banking. We need mission-oriented public and cooperative banks that are explicitly mandated to finance these non-revenue-generating life necessities, regardless of strict collateral legibility.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered the catastrophic danger of expanding legibility without a corresponding revenue stream? The text itself contains a very specific, crucial warning here. Indiscriminate lending destroys savings.
Well, I am not suggesting indiscriminate lending.
But how does a cooperative bank fund non-revenue adaptation without going bankrupt? Commercial banks rely on collateral and cash flow legibility because it is the only empirical, mathematically sound way to ensure that the purchasing power they are creating will actually be matched by future productive capacity.
Okay, but
when a bank makes a loan, it creates money. If that money doesn't produce goods or services to absorb it, you get inflation and financial collapse. If you start using public banks to load non-revenue generating adaptation projects with commercial debt, you are not solving a problem. You are converting ecological vulnerability into acute financial fragility.
But you're assuming the only productive capacity that matters is one that generates a financial return.
From a banking perspective, yes. The text explicitly states that loading these projects with debt is dangerous. Furthermore, when you remove the strict discipline of financial return, history shows us that public banks often become channels of political patronage. They end up funding projects based on electoral cycles and political favors, not viable, sustainable futures.
Of the territory. Let's say a corporate enterprise looks highly profitable on paper. It generates plenty of revenue to service its debt.
Sure.
But it only looks profitable because the ecological damage it causes, polluting a local river, emitting carbon, is left completely off the balance sheet. It is literally extracting physical value from the life ground and recording it as a financial profit.
Externalities exist. Yes. Nobody denies that.
But they aren't just minor accounting errors. They are the core of the crisis. When I speak of plural banking, I am talking about the text's call for plural diagnosis and the enforcement of an ecological ceiling. Some limits are physical. They cannot be negotiated away by a high financial return.
Right.
A project that destroys a watershed is physically and morally illegitimate, regardless of its cash flow. We need institutions capable of recognizing that physical reality, rather than hiding behind the organized not knowing of a standard credit model.
I don't disagree that environmental externalities are a massive challenge, but the dangers of borrowing without future revenue are most evident when we scale this exact problem up to the macro level. Let's take that exact problem, borrowing for survival without a clear revenue stream, and look at it on a national scale. The text explores this deeply through the small island diagnostic.
Ah, yes. Sovereign debt.
Yes. Sovereign debt enforces necessary discipline on states. A state must retain market access to survive in a globalized world. Now, you propose this post-payment condition metric from the text, the idea that a sovereign state should look at what resources are left for its own citizens, its social floor, after paying its foreign debt.
Exactly.
And if it decides that paying the debt hurts its social floor too much, it shouldn't pay.
It should prioritize its citizen survival over foreign creditors, yes.
But if a sovereign state unilaterally adopts that metric and defaults based on a qualitative assessment of its social floor, the market reaction will be swift and devastating. It will trigger immediate capital flight. More importantly, the state will lose access to correspondent banking.
We should probably clarify correspondent banking for a second.
Sure. It is the essential plumbing of global finance. It's the network of agreements that allows a local bank in, say, Jamaica to send U.S. dollars to a supplier in Miami. It's how international trade happens.
Right.
If a country defaults and gets cut off from correspondent banking, local businesses literally cannot pay foreign suppliers for food, fuel, or medicine. International trade stops overnight. The country will suffer the exact foreign exchange constraint the text describes. Strict adherence to debt contracts, even when painful, prevents opportunistic repudiation and maintains the trust required for international capital to flow to developing nations at all.
I'm not convinced by that line of reasoning, because you are framing this as if states are just being fiscally irresponsible and need harsh discipline. But that completely ignores the structural reality of the Caribbean debt disaster dependency cycle detailed in the text.
Okay, walk me through it.
Let's break down how this cycle actually works, step by step, because it proves my point. A Category 5 hurricane hits a small island state. This is an external, exogenous, ecological shock, largely driven by historic emissions from the global north.
Right, it is not a domestic policy failure.
Exactly. The physical damage immediately wipes out local productive capacity. Consequently, the state's need for imports, building materials, emergency medicine, fuels, surges precisely at the moment its foreign exchange revenue from tourism or agriculture collapses.
A massive fiscal gap opens up instantly.
Yes. And the state is forced to borrow externally, often at predatory market rates, just to rebuild basic infrastructure.
Which adds to their overall debt burden.
Exactly. Fast forward a few years, and future national budgets are entirely consumed by debt service. The interest payments eat up the money they need. This severely constrains their ability to invest in climate adaptation, making them even more vulnerable when the next hurricane hits. The future of that nation is, as the text says, owned in advance.
Yeah, it's a brutal cycle.
To tell that country that market discipline requires them to gut their healthcare system to pay foreign bondholders is temporal domination. It is using the financial map to obliterate the physical territory.
I will concede that the small state refinancing trap you just described is a genuine structural flaw in the international architecture. It is absolutely true that structural vulnerability raises borrowing costs, and those high costs prevent investment in resilience. It's a vicious cycle. But the text also points out a cold, hard reality. Simply erasing the debt doesn't fix the underlying foreign exchange constraint.
But it frees up capital.
Local currency, maybe. But the country still needs U.S. dollars to buy fuel and medicine on the global market. Defaulting doesn't magically create those dollars. It just ensures nobody will lend them to you again. Therefore, the solution is not to overthrow the hierarchy of claims. The solution is to innovate within it.
Innovate how, exactly?
By using mechanisms that respect the financial constitution. I agree with the text that we need instruments like CCRIF.
The Caribbean Catastrophe Risk Insurance Facility.
Yes, which relies on parametric insurance. This is brilliant because it removes the friction. Instead of waiting 6 months for claims adjusters to fly down, assess hurricane damage, and haggle over payouts, parametric insurance relies on data.
Right, triggers.
The moment a verified hurricane hits a specific wind speed over the island, the policy is triggered and liquidity is wired automatically. It is rapid, rules-based, and it doesn't add to the sovereign debt burden.
That is a step forward, certainly.
We also need regional compliance utilities to pool sovereignty so small states can maintain that vital correspondent banking access by sharing the massive cost of global regulatory compliance. We need longer maturities on bonds. But all of these mechanisms must operate within the existing financial constitution.
And I disagree there.
They still rely on the absolute legal enforceability of contracts. If you declare, as you suggest, that states are suddenly ecological creditors and can just net out their financial debts against historical carbon emissions, you will destroy the very market access they need to fund their green transitions.
But treating small states as ecological creditors isn't about arbitrary repudiation or tearing up contracts for fun. It's about correcting a glaring systemic asymmetry in institutional recognition. The Global Ledger recognizes a sovereign bond with absolute legal precision. If you owe $1 million, the global courts will hunt you down.
True.
But that same Global Ledger treats the preservation of ocean ecosystems, biodiversity, and carbon sinks as a free externality. The Global North extracts that value without paying. We must integrate disaster clauses and state contingent debt, yes, but we also must transition to a framework where climate finance arrives as grants and reparative transfers for non-revenue adaptation. We cannot keep loading vulnerable states with commercial debt for surviving a climate crisis they did not cause.
Grants are entirely appropriate for non-revenue adaptation. We agree there. But let's be realistic about where grants come from. They rely on the fiscal capacity and tax base of the donor states. And that fiscal capacity relies entirely on the wealth generated by a functioning, disciplined, legible global financial system.
Which is currently failing the planet.
But you simply cannot fund a global climate transition without mobilizing private capital at an unprecedented scale. And private capital will not flow across borders without the strict legibility and contract enforceability that you are currently critiquing.
As we bring this down to our conclusion, I think we have clearly outlined two very distinct paradigms for the future of money in society. From my perspective, Dr. Saheli's text proves that credit is delegated public power. It relies on publicly constituted legal and monetary systems to function at all.
Mm-hmm. Therefore, it absolutely must serve a public purpose. We have to transition from claim sovereignty, where the rigid financial contract dictates reality, to life sovereignty, where the financial system is explicitly ordered to protect, restore, and enlarge human and ecological capacities first. The ultimate test of any financial system is the life dividend it leaves behind. The future must inherit durable physical and social capability, not just a ledger of compound obligations.
And my summary remains that the rigid enforceability of financial claims is the foundational technology of modern civilization. Yes, it relies on a degree of organized not knowing to function at scale. We have to simplify the world to price it.
The map.
Right, but that exact simplification is what allows us to build durable states, pool unimaginable risks across the globe, and mobilize massive resources over decades. To subordinate that disciplined system to fluid, highly qualitative metrics of social or ecological value is to dismantle the very machinery that allows us to manage complexity and survive as a globally integrated society.
We do find significant points of convergence, however. We both recognize that the current system's friction points are causing real physical harm.
Absolutely.
The vulnerabilities in correspondent banking, the compliance paradox where small states are literally priced out of the global economy, just trying to meet regulatory standards, these require urgent structural innovation.
Definitely. We both agree on the necessity of governed interdependence. Neither total autarky nor unchecked brutal market exposure works for vulnerable nations. And I fully agree with the text's assertion that fidelity is not captivity.
Right.
There must be legal mechanisms for orderly sovereign debt restructuring. When a debt becomes mathematically impossible to pay without destroying a society's foundation, the system needs a pressure valve that works efficiently.
The depth of Dr. Saheli's historical and institutional analysis in the sovereignty of credit is truly profound. It forces us to ask a foundational question. Is our financial architecture fundamentally a mechanism of temporal cooperation, allowing us to build together across time? Or is it a mechanism of temporal domination, allowing the past to systematically extract from the future?
It is a text that will fundamentally challenge your assumptions about how the world works, regardless of which side of the ledger you currently sit on.
You know, it brings us right back to that map we discussed at the very beginning. We have spent centuries perfecting the precision of the lines. We know the exact coordinates of the debts, the rigid borders of the collateral, the intricate topography of the financial claims.
Yeah.
But the map is only useful if there is still a living, breathing territory left to navigate when we finally arrive at our destination. Thank you for joining us.